This is Jane Nelson with Focusing on Solutions from PositiveDiscipline.com. And today I have a very special guest, Dr. Stanton Peel, who has written a book called Addiction Proof Your Child. And every once in a while you find somebody who agrees with just about everything you say, and that's the fun people to talk to. And when I first got Dr. Peel's book and I started reading it, I found out I was underlining practically every word. And so I do highly recommend that everyone get this book, Addiction Proof Your Child. And welcome, Dr. Peel. It's such a pleasure to be able to talk to you.
Thanks so much for your kind words. Very much appreciated.
And one of the things I'd like to start with is getting to what does not work. And then we'll talk about some of the basic problems and then what does work. So I do want people to know that we'll be getting to that. But you and I are what I call unconventional thinkers that just don't go along with the conventional thinking about things. And sometimes that's not...
Don't tell everybody that.
Right, exactly.
I'm worried that they'll learn about that.
Well, they can't read your book without knowing that. But it's like sometimes I just think that when people believe in so much of the conventional thinking, it's like they're parenting with what we call paper bags on their head. It's like they're not really looking at the results of what they're doing.
Well, it's amazing. If you just, the government's own statistics, you don't have to be a radical to come up with these things. The government does a survey, a national survey on drug use and health, and they look at how kids behave with regards to drugs and alcohol. And this is the 2006 results. Three-quarters of 18-year-olds have drunk alcohol. 46% have drunk alcohol in the last month. That's about a half. And a third have binged in the last month, five or more drinks at once. At the age of 20, 86% have drunk, 57% have drunk in the last month, and 40% have binged in the last month. By the time they're 21, when, of course, they can drink... there's a tremendous movement in the United States to eliminate underage drinking. That's never, ever going to happen. We're not even talking about something that a majority of kids do. We're talking about something that virtually all kids do. And they don't do it very well when you have 40% binging. And then, of course, by the time they become 21, they can drink legally. 90% have drunk, 70% have drunk in the last month, and 50% have binged in the last month. So the result of our current approach of burying our head in the sand and saying, well, we have a zero-tolerance policy, which means what? It's constantly disregarded, and the results are disastrous. It's, of course, binge drinking that we're really the most worried about. That's what results in unsafe behavior, DUIs and possible accidents and unsafe sexual behavior. So we're bringing about the worst possible outcomes that we can. And it's almost as though what we're saying is, yes, things are terrible, but we told them not to drink. So we're in the clear. It's as though just by announcing a completely improvident and impossible goal that we feel satisfied that we're doing the right thing, even though it's totally ineffectual.
Well, exactly. And one of the things that I'm always talking to parents about is look at the results and actually... I think that there should be more about do unto your children as you would have done unto you as far as parenting goes, because how many of us as adults want to listen to just lectures when somebody tells us what to do and how to do it and when we should do it, and we don't have any sense of power or say? It's like, what do we as adults usually do? We would either rebel or comply if we're approval junkies, and then we wonder why these kind of lectures don't work with kids. And I love what you say about the DARE project. And
ironically, I was just talking, I'm just invited in the town. I describe an addiction proof your child going to a local high school where they're having parent kind of education tonight. And just as they do with the kids, they just lectured about one bad thing that's happened. You don't know how many, I go to classes, a woman will say, and I'll say, how many people in this class have never been drunk? And out of 30 kids, one or two will raise their hand. And kids are getting drunk and they're having unsafe sex, and just a tremendous litany of all the bad things that are happening. And I got up and I said, if you've been giving the same lecture for years, maybe even decades, and these are the bad results, why do you expect any better results from doing the exact same thing? And then I said, by the way, I hate to offend the DARE officer here, and he told an incredible story about two kids who smoked marijuana, and they went out and they freaked out, and one of them ended up breaking into a house, and he cut his arm and he bled to death. And I'm thinking, kids are going to really pay attention to this. I mean, how many kids kill themselves smoking marijuana? It's not a very realistic warning. And then I said, the data show that DARE doesn't work, and the police chief was the moderator, and he said, you can't prove a negative. And I said to the police chief, well, with all due respect, sir, you're a good police chief, I'm sure, but they do develop, people get PhDs in epidemiology, and they'll have a certain number of schools where they do run DARE and others where they don't, and then they'll check their behavior for years following it, and then they publish the results, and they determine that it's not helpful. And then the police chief said to me, sir, this isn't a debate here tonight. Have you seen any television recently where they tasered some kid in Florida for asking some question? I started having visions that was what was going to happen to me. And as I left, a guy came up to me from the local Y, and he said, we very much want you to present your point of view to our group. We need an alternative point of view. The kids all say that this is completely unrealistic.
Well, I think that that's one of the things that we don't realize is that kids aren't stupid. And when they hear these kind of things, it just then, like you say in your book, they just discount everything we say. They don't trust us. They don't believe us. But it's like, as you're saying, there's the government studies, but it's also, I think, that parents often stick their heads in the sand and they all think, not my child, because I told them, because I've lectured, because I've done all this. Right. And you do mention this landmark study that found that moderate, I'm reading right from your book, experimentation with drugs characterized the most psychologically healthy adolescents, while heavier use and abstinence were both signs of poor adjustment. And I have heard of that research where they found that kids with really healthy self-esteem might try drugs, but they did never abuse them.
Or, well, one of my points in Addiction Proof Your Child is, if your goal, what is your goal with your children? Is your goal, well, I'm going to protect them until they, until when? And then they'll be safe. That logic makes no sense. By the time they're 21, they can drink alcohol legally, and we know that 50% of them are going to binge drink regularly. So you can't get out from under that, for starters. A majority of high school seniors have consumed an illicit drug. I hate to tell parents that. The fastest growing illicit drug use, of course, now is pharmaceuticals. And one in five teenagers, counting, starting with 13-year-olds through 19-year-olds, has consumed a painkiller like OxyContin recreationally. And those are the most powerful and dangerous drugs. You cannot have as your goal the absolute protection of your child, because that's impossible. And we haven't even gotten yet to what the AMA almost classified video games as addictive. Or what about addictive shopping? Or what about addictive gambling, which is taking place on college campuses? Or what about pornography addictions? But
cell phone texting. I mean, I just see kids, they're just texting away all the time, like they just can't live without it.
And we're not talking. And what makes an addiction, as I describe an addiction proof your child, isn't trivial. It's when you're so involved in an activity that has detrimental effects for your life that it's in detracting from your entire existence. You're becoming depressed, you're losing track of school. When you reach that point with any activity, it becomes an addiction. But the point that you are emphasizing is this: how do kids become addicted? How do they become dependent? When they don't have enough confidence and enough skill to manage their lives. That's the goal. The goal is to produce a child who is going to be able to cope with the challenges that they face of one kind or another. in life.
Exactly.
There are going to be a million challenges. We didn't even talk about the biggest addiction of all, which is food. American children are out of control of their eating. You know, I cite the statistics that show how vastly obesity and child, adolescent overweight and obesity is increasing. If you can't manage your involvements with substances, starting with food, with people, and with activities, I don't want to put it too strongly by saying you're doomed, but you're going to encounter problems throughout your life. And what you are doing, you're not protecting your child from every danger. That's not the right way to think about it. You're engaging with your child in a constructive way so that they become confident and able to deal with the challenges that they face throughout life. That's what you're doing.
Exactly. I think that is so important, and I want to get to that in just a minute, because I just want to say one other thing about what we're doing that doesn't work, and that's when we try to motivate by fear. And through the lectures, and then just think that works without looking at the facts of what does. And I was talking even to some of my grandchildren and their friends, and they just verify everything you're saying, that everybody, I mean, the statistics you quoted say that 50%, but what the kids say, if you talk to them, they say everybody drinks, everybody. And so teaching them how to drink responsibly is so much more important and valuable, as far as I'm concerned, than...
Well, I did have an article recently in the Wall Street Journal where I pointed out, and it's in the book, one study came out and it said parents who allow their kids to go to drinking parties are twice as likely, the kids are twice as likely to binge. That same study found that children who drink at home with their parents are one-third as likely to binge. When you confidently introduce alcohol, if you drink, to your children in an appropriate setting, an appropriate social occasion or a religious ceremony, you're actually inoculating them against the dangers in the world out there. That is so much more constructive than giving them pointless lectures, which we know aren't going to happen. And 90% of kids do drink by the time they're 21. I agree with you, it's more than half. And more than half of them drink regularly. If you tell them just don't do this, you're just spitting in the wind, and you make a very excellent point. It's not respectful. It's almost bizarrely, almost psychotic to just lecture your kids about things that aren't going to ring true, but it's also not giving them the kind of respect that, as you pointed out, you would want to receive yourself. And how do you give people respect? You take them into account as a human being. You find out what their experience is and what their opinion is and what is important to them. What's wrong with their lectures is, for better or worse, police are better at telling scare stories than interacting with children. And as I describe in Addiction Proof Your Child, I have many exercises around this. You need to learn to ask questions. You need to reserve expressing your own value judgments. You need to allow yourself to hear what your child has to say. And sometimes they'll say things that are very reassuring and sensible. They themselves know the difference between dangerous drug use and drinking and casual drug use and drinking. They themselves know, will be able to say things like, well, I would never let it interfere with school. On the other hand, maybe they are worried about their own behavior. Maybe they are having problems. Maybe they want to talk to you about that. But if you're going to fly off the handle, if you're going to be incapable of taking in the information, you're going to hurt your child. And in Addiction Proof Your Child, I describe several cases. One of a girl in New Jersey who stole the family car, went to New York, got really drunk. The car was impounded. She went to the impound lot, and the girl she was with passed out. She became frightened, and she ran away from the impound lot, which is in a very dangerous part of New York. She was picked up by a pimp, raped, and killed. She was 18 years old. When they interviewed her father, he said, I wish she would have called me. I would have bawled the hell out of her, but I would have told her at least that I'd come and pick her up. But that's not how you get kids to tell you when they're in trouble. you need to make a deal with them. And I have a whole chapter devoted to something called risk reduction. Without telling your children that you're approving of them drinking or certainly getting drunk, you need to communicate to them that you're their parent. When they're in real trouble, all other judgments are suspended. You're there to make sure that they're all right. That's the primary goal. And what that's about, as I point out in Addiction Proof, is most adolescents outgrow risk-taking behavior, including excessive drinking and drug use. The only thing that's going to prevent them is if they get really sidetracked on the one hand, or if they have a serious accident or something bad happens to them. And that's one of your main goals, to protect your children, to make sure nothing life-threatening occurs to them, which is going to require a little bit of honest communication.
But also, you talk about ways to inoculate your children or risk reduction. And one of my favorites that you talk about is motivational interviewing. And of course, I have to tell you that one of the reasons it's my favorite is because I call it curiosity questions. But the point is that you are helping children think for themselves. And if you don't mind, I would like to read just one of the examples that you have in the book about Warren.
God bless you.
Yes.
Go for it.
Warren, let's count your friends. Warren was an extremely shy and passive child. For instance, he refused to interact with any adults other than his mother and father. Warren's parents, Stu and Grace, recognized this was a problem, and they thought carefully about how to help Warren emerge from the protective shell he built for himself. They arranged for Warren to be with other kids by taking friends of Warren's with them on weekend excursions. By kindergarten, Warren had a small group of pals. But when they came to the house, he was very finicky about his positions. For example, he sulked when they didn't put away his toys. He fought with several of his friends over this. So here comes the motivational interviewing. Stu sat down with Warren one day. "How many friends do you have, Warren?" Stu asked. Warren named four. Stu then asked, "Who was already very good at math? How many of your friends did you fight with in the last 2 weeks?" "Two." "What percentage of all your friends is that?" "Half," Warren answered. Stu concluded, "What will the percentage be if you fight with one or both of your other friends?" Warren considered his answer for a moment, then asked to excuse himself. He was more tolerant of his friends' shortcomings the next time one visited. And the thing about this that I love is it's like really helping children think for themselves. And when we do that, they come to the conclusions we want them to. If his father had just lectured to him and said, "Well, you pretty soon you're going to lose them all. You've already lost half." That's what makes children shut down.
Well, it makes every human being shut down.
Exactly.
I mean, this book also has chapters on treatment. We have a style of treatment in the United States where a person comes in and you say to them, "What's your problem?" They say, "I'm not sure what my problem is. I have a drunk driving. Sometimes I drink too much." And then our style is to say, "You're an alcoholic. Don't you see it? You're in denial." When you attack people in general and kids, they are always going to react and build up resistance. That's the way human beings are. That's the way you and I are.
Exactly.
If you instead ask them to consider their life from their own perspective and what means the most to them, you get an entirely different response. If you can get on a wavelength with somebody where you're saying, "What's important to you? What do you want to have? And you want to have friends. How are you doing with your friends?" Instead of attacking them, they're going to see you as an asset that's going to help them get what they want. That's how people work. And it takes a little bit of skill, but as I describe in Addiction Proof Your Child, by learning to ask questions, you can learn to motivate your child to work in their own best interest. And when they do that, they go away, as you point out, with the skills to deal with life. They're not taking your nagging with them in their mind. They've worked through in their own mind what's important to them and how they're going to deal with these things.
And this is one of the most important things you talk about is how important it is to give children opportunity to learn skills. And by the way, you can't give them skills, but you can provide opportunities for them to learn them. And you talk about several that are very important, like delaying gratification. And, well, actually, one that we need to talk about, even though it's still one of those what we shouldn't do, but it's so huge. It is so huge how parents are overprotecting their children and doing too much for them. And so that kids don't ever learn that I'm capable, that I can contribute, that I have...
I have a list of things that you learn from independent activity. You learn how to manage your own time. And I use it as an example. If you're a grandmother, you might be nearly as old as I am.
I have 20 grandchildren.
Oh, Lord.
So.
I'm just about to become a grandfather for the first time. At the same time that I have a 19-year-old who's a sophomore at college, Anna, and I dedicate this book to Anna as my addiction-proof child. So, by the way, I'm going to Florence with her early next month, where I hate to tell Americans, they're going to serve her alcohol legally. She's 19. They're not going to think twice about it. But I think she can handle it. But independent activity means a child comes up against the world on their own. And when you and I were young, we used to do things like take long bike rides on a Saturday. They used to call them bike hikes. Maybe your parents would give you a peanut butter. Now you get arrested if you do this. You give the kid a peanut butter and jelly sandwich, and they leave the house at 8, and you say, be home by dinner. And then they'd come home, and they'd ramble around the woods. They'd get lost. They'd get scratches. They'd fight with their friends. They'd make up with their friends. They'd find their way home. That kind of experience is so invaluable. It's irreplaceable.
Absolutely.
It shows you that you can handle life. And one of the most important things is it shows you, even if you have a few negative turns during the course of your bike ride, like you fall off your bike or you get in a disagreement or you get lost, this is so important, that you can overcome setbacks. There's no more important lesson to learn in life, and it's very important. People who are not capable of enduring pain and setbacks are more likely to become addicted. Well, they're more likely to turn to some kind of addictive remedy when they run into trouble rather than confronting their actual problem.
Exactly. That's what I talk about a lot, is that we don't allow children to develop their disappointment muscles, and that they to figure out that they can handle upsets and that they can survive and that they can even learn some lessons along the way.
Perfect. And that's so crucial for addiction. Why do people take painkillers? Why do people become addicted to drugs like heroin and alcohol? They're pain forgetters. They're ways of forgetting anxiety and problems because you're not capable psychologically of facing up to them directly. So the thing you've been lecturing about them is crucial to people being able to avoid addiction. There's no better sign that, addiction is now called alcohol or drug dependence in the major psychiatric manual. If children are overly dependent, you're setting them up for the very thing that you most fear.
Exactly. I want to just read, we're almost out of time, but I want to read a list that you have on page 101 of what do children do less of all the time. And it's what you explained, that they just don't have time to practice managing. We don't allow them to manage on their own. And that self-directed activity contributes to virtually all the values and abilities that combat addiction, such as independence, the belief and value that they can take care of themselves, competence, the actual ability to deal with life, overcoming obstacles, solving problems on their own, involvement. Children invest more time in activities they select themselves, using imagination and creativity, learning to daydream and have an empty mind, learning to deal with people, responsibility, planning and conducting activities, handling consequences, and that's one of the things I think is allowing children to experience the consequences of their choices in a supportive manner instead of, well, that's what I told you, instead of, gee, that must be feel bad, what did you learn from that? But still, so that they can talk to us because they don't feel that they're going to get blame or shame. But that
Anna just, at the age of 19, got a job in New York City as a waitress in a really fancy restaurant. Well, the next youngest server was 26, Anna was 19. I was so proud of her. I thought, this girl's going to be able to survive. Eventually, she got fired. She couldn't really open a bottle of wine very well. She wasn't technically that gifted. She felt really bad about it, but I didn't have to tell her that she screwed up. She understood. She took on a big challenge. It was a little bit over her head. You know, that's an intense environment. She did her best. She's going to have to try and start out maybe, you know, working at a diner or something to work her skills up. I didn't have to give her any negative feedback. I just had to tell her I was proud of her because she had experienced disappointment. She knew what she had to do. She took the information in. She didn't need any ganging up on her to learn what she had, how she had to improve her life.
It's amazing that as adults, I bet that we can all share many, many experiences of how we dealt with disappointment. We had to, and yet with our children, so often we want to overprotect them, rescue them, and all of those things that certainly don't addiction-proof them. And so, Dr. Peel, we are out of time, and I've really enjoyed talking with you, and I'm going to suggest again that everyone purchase your book, Addiction Proof Your Child, and it will be available on my website, positivedisciplined.com. And I'm going to also include some statements from your book and an article that I did on talking to your children about drugs on my blog.
Which I read, which was excellent.
Yeah, because you can see that we agree.
We do. Maybe you'll put a link to my website. I do have www.peel.net.
Yes, I went to that. It looked like you have some excellent information there.
And so, I also have a addictionproofyourchild.com website, too. Maybe you can link when you get up on your website.
Absolutely. Wonderful. Absolutely.
This has been the best darn interview. Next time I'll call you up and interview you for my podcast. I don't have a podcast, but anyhow, you're really on the ball.
Well, thank
really
you so much. And I just hope everybody reads your book because it's bringing some sanity into what I think is just a lot of insanity that people are just...
And how could you... You wouldn't mislead them because you're a grandmother, for God's sakes.
Well, there's other reasons why I wouldn't mislead them, too.
Right, because you're a solid professional. That combines with it. Thanks so much for having me on. It's
thank
been a pleasure.
You. Thank you. Goodbye. This is Dr. Jane Nelson with Focusing on Solutions from PositiveDiscipline.com. Until next time.